Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. Barack Obama will be president very shortly, president of the United States of America, and two educational thinkers in our country, very different men with very different ideas. Both have kind of written, one has written a letter to President Obama, and the other has written an idea to President Obama. We're going to talk first in the course of this hour with Dr. Howard Gardner, who's been a guest on the show before. He's the Hobbs Professor of Cognition Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He's known for his theory of multiple intelligences, a critique that rejects the notion that there exists a single human intelligence. He's written over 20 books, including Frames of Mind, Theory of Multiple Intelligence, Five Minds for the Future, Learning Minds, Changing Minds, and Extraordinary Minds. He recently published an open letter we'll talk about today to Barack Obama on advising him on education. You can read this at our website as we're talking about this at www.steinershow.org. Before I introduce Dr. Gardner to you all, let me remind you all to join us for the 6th Annual Annapolis Political Summit and Breakfast next Wednesday, January the 14th at Phillips Seafood Restaurant in Annapolis. I'll be interviewing Governor Martin O'Malley, Speaker of the House Mike Bush, Senate President Mike Miller in front of you, live audience. We're taking questions from the audience. It's your chance to talk about all the issues of the day that's important to you, that are important to you when it comes to the future of the state, whether it's slots, gay rights, energy policy, capital punishment, the cuts because of the economy, how it affects all of our futures, your mortgages. So join me there from 7:30 to 9:30 a.m. You can call 443-934-1111 or email us at steinershow@gmail.com or visit our website at steinershow.org for more information. And we invite you to join us. It can be a very important morning. It can be broadcast here later on WEAA and several other radio stations around the state and in Washington, D.C. But you can please join us there that morning. And now let me welcome our guest, Dr. Howard Gardner. It's a pleasure to talk with you once again.
Hi, Mark. Good to be here.
So I was really fascinated by this letter you wrote. Someone sent it to me by mail, and then I heard you again on one of my favorite programs in XM, Bob Edwards Show. And I said, this is a fascinating conversation. We have to have it here. I love the way you begin the letter to Barack Obama. You say, many individuals advise you about what to do. I suggest that you don't do anything, at least for a while, when it comes to education.
Yes, undoubtedly there are going to be people pushing Obama to say no child left behind is good or no child left behind is bad. You should have vouchers. You shouldn't have vouchers. You should get rid of unions. You should double teacher salaries. You should make sure that this curriculum is featured or that curriculum is featured. And in fact, I think that there have been so many recommendations, often of contrary import and of contrary direction in recent years, that the last thing we need are more programs and more ideas. I didn't really expect that Obama will either get my letter or read it, but in fact, events have conspired to make this probably necessary. We hear today on the news that there's going to be over $1 trillion deficit. Mm-hmm. There are wars raging all around the world. We're in financial meltdown. So Barack Obama is going to have other things on his plate. But I don't want to come off as having been totally negative. I think they're very important issues of tone and of direction and of modeling where Obama can be very important. I'm happy to talk about those.
And let's go through some of these things. I mean, you begin the letter to President Obama, President-elect Obama now, that you submit that in this country we need both good workers and good citizens, that schools can help supply but not alone. I really love that approach. And the question is, I mean, how you think we get to those steps?
Well, having looked at education systems all over the world, I think there are two things whose importance dominates everything else. In fact, everything else is footnotes. It's just little commentaries. The first thing are families that are involved in education with their children. And this doesn't mean that the parents have to teach the children. After all, that's what schools and the media do. But it means that schooling has to be important and education has to be important in the family. Time has to be made to work with young people. The importance of the life of mind, the importance of talking about things seriously, the importance of written material and other kinds of media material need to be important in the family. And when you have families that are uninvolved I mean, by families, I don't just mean here parents, because sometimes they're not available, but grandparents, siblings, extended family. When education is valued, that's crucial. About 15 years ago, we did a small study in China and the United States, and we simply asked kids in both countries, draw a picture of what it looks like in your home in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Just about every Chinese child drew himself or herself sitting at a kitchen table with one of the other parents next to them working on homework. Mark, not a single American child drew a picture like that. A typical child drew himself, herself in the bedroom. There were no computers then, but they were watching television or listening to their Walkman or talking on the phone to kids. And obviously that signals that around the household, taking learning seriously is not very important. So that's the first factor. And it's up to parents, but, you know, Barack Obama is a very impressive family man. So is Michelle. And obviously they care about the kids. Education is important to them. And to signal that, especially, I would say, to inner city families where there may be some ambivalence about how important school learning is would be crucial. The other thing takes much more time. All that Obama can do is to help move in the right direction, and that is a teaching cohort that is professional, behaves professionally, and receives the respect and the income of a professional. I'm not saying here that teachers need to make five times as much more money than they do at the present time, but teaching is not looked up to in this country in the way it is in places like Finland, Korea, Hungary, places which are totally different from one another but have effective educational systems. And I have a very simple litmus test for this. When I'm at a party and somebody asks me what my children do, when I mention that two of them are in education and one of them is in a classroom teacher, I don't hear people saying, that's great. Mm-hmm. I see people hearing and thinking, well, you know, why aren't they on Wall Street? Or why aren't they a lawyer making 100 times more than a teacher? And those two things, number one, education being respected and prioritized within the family, broadly construed, not just parents, but the whole family. And number two, an atmosphere where teachers, education people are taken seriously because they deserve to be taken seriously. And of course, that's a very important hedge there, because many of our teachers are not very well trained. Many of them see it as just a job, quote unquote, and that's not what a professional is. A professional is an individual who earns respect and status, a certain degree of autonomy, and a reasonable income in return for being well educated and making complex judgments under conditions of uncertainty. And here the complex judgments, of course, are what's best for the kids who are under my care.
We're talking to
I would love Barack Obama to think in those veins and not worry too much about the details of one bit of legislation or another, because I think especially in education, Mark, where 90 or 95% of the budget is at a state level, it's not federal spending, it's the bully pulpit and the role model and the kinds of things that the president says, the kinds of people he invites to the White House, the kinds of classes he visits and so on. That's where the power is, and not in one piece of legislation or another.
We're talking with Dr. Howard Gardner, who's the Hobbs Professor of Cognition and Education at Harvard University's School of Education, the man who developed the theory of multiple intelligences, a critique that says there's more than just a single intelligence now. People view the world and how they learn. And has written an open letter to President Obama, Don't Do Anything. It's titled about education. Join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Many of you are in school. Your students were listening, have children in school, care about education, where education is going, and talking to one of our preeminent educational thinkers and scholars. So please join us here at 410-319-8888. There's a subtext to what you see here that I want to talk about. I mean, it seems to me that part of what you're saying, with all of the No Child Left Behind that is the law of the land at the moment, and standardized tests, that you're saying when you give your example about excellent education systems that are very different from one another, Finland, Korea, Sweden, Singapore, you mentioned in your letter, where teachers are treated like professionals and families respect education, that's what you just finished talking about, that you're talking about something pretty revolutionary and radical here, unless you're not saying this, which is that all the movement toward standardized tests, merit pay, national curriculum, are exactly the wrong things that a national government should be doing in education, that we should be doing something more to A, inspire people in this nation, and B, to really train teachers and create a professional teaching group in America that's different than we have now, and let the rest kind of fall away.
Right, there's one other factor, Mark, which I didn't mention, which is very important. Many of the countries which are most effective in education have quite a homogeneous population, and there it's easier to have a single law and a single standard.
Mm-hmm.
The United States is incredibly varied. Education is still very much at the local level. The way I communicate this in just a phrase is we couldn't design an educational system which would please the three Jessies,
right.
Jesse Helms, Jesse Jackson, and Jesse Ventura. And that's a flip remark, but the serious remark is what we need in the inner city is not what we need in the heartland, and it's also not what we need in the more affluent suburbs and in the more affluent cities. I've analyzed this, and I talk about it in terms of three E's. The E that's most important in the inner city are kids who are excellent in learning. And No Child Left Behind is devoted to that particular cohort. The problem in the heartland is not that kids aren't graduating and going on to some kind of education. It's that they're not engaged. The engagement is missing. School is just something that they go through, but they don't care that much about learning. And once they leave school, it atrophies pretty quickly. The third thing, which I have been thinking so much about for the last 15 years, and it's finally come home to roost, is that the children of affluence, and this I would have to include most of the people I know, the E that's missing there is ethics. We have kids who do well enough on their tests and, you know, who go on to colleges, often to elite colleges. Often they find having their mind engaged to be fine, but they walk ethical fine lines. They do things which ultimately are not good for the country. And before anybody gets too upset, think about the problems we have now in the country. We're in wars that it'd be better if we were not in, and we have a financial meltdown which is going to cost a generation. Neither of these was caused by the inner city. Neither of these was caused by the heartland. These was caused by the best and the brightest. I have to say, students that go to a university like mine, like Harvard, but it's 100 universities, where the kids do fine academically, but they are too often greedy, and too often they walk an ethical, very fine line. They go to work for investment banking, or they go to work in management consultancies. They get high salaries, much higher than the people who are their teachers. But one of the reasons they're getting a high salary is to develop instruments which other people can't even understand. When you have some of these financial papers that were developed in the last 10, 15 years, which people like George Soros and Warren Buffett say they don't even understand, these multiple derivatives,
right,
these credit swaps and so on, these were not developed by the kids in Harlem. They were not developed by the kids in Kansas. They were developed by the best and the brightest of the Harvard graduates who do not go on directly to professional school. 58% of our students go on either to Wall Street or to management consultant, investment banking or management consultant. I have nothing against this per se, but think of the problems that were caused by that sector. And so for me, having an ethical country where ethics are respected and where people who do not behave ethically are first reprimanded and then dismissed, that's very important. And, you know, we've had an ethical disaster at the state and federal level over the last 30 or 40 years. And it's not just Republican or not just Democratic. And one of the things that, again, an Obama administration can do is to make it very clear that if there's a cloud over you, you are not going to be serving in the government. Government service should be a distinction for people who are ethically impeccable and not a place where you can sell a Senate seat or where you get appointed to high office even though you're under investigation, as what happened recently with Bill Richardson. So I'd like more focus on ethics and less focus on your SAT, because I think our problems, what's made America great in the past was people admired the country and wanted to be here because they looked up to our freedoms. They looked up to the chances, to the chance you had to get ahead. And frankly, it looked up to the government, which they saw as being clean. Nobody in the world thinks of our government like that anymore. And that's a much more important repairing than, you know, one aspect or another of a bit of federal legislation.
Howard Gardner, I want to open the phones here, but I want to come back to this kind of parse out some of the things you just said, because I really want to explore how this, we apply this to educational policy and change educational policy in America when it comes to having a nation with so many school districts and no two schools were alike, or no two school systems were alike, really, in America. So I'm going to come back to that, but let me get to the phones first at 410-319-8888. If you talk to Dr. Howard Gardner about the future of education in America, he's written an open letter to President Obama, don't do anything. 410-319-8888. Sherry in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Hi, Sherry.
I was calling. I'm a clinical social worker, and I work with children. But I wanted to know, how is the impact of the children being diagnosed with autism and different behavioral discontrol and mental health problems impacting the education system of today?
We are much more aware than we were 30 or 40 years ago of the kinds of difficulties kids can have in learning, either cognitive difficulties, which would happen if you have reading problems, dyslexia or mathematics problems, dyscalculia, or some of the emotional problems, some of the abuse problems. And of course, autism is a very extreme condition. What we call the Asperger's syndrome is the more common one. And naturally, as we make more demands educationally, it's very important to know about these problems and to be able as best we can to deal with them. On the other hand, I also think that we have what we might call the medical student disease. The medical students learn about every possible disease and they discover they have symptoms. I sometimes go to a social affair where I don't meet anybody who doesn't say they have attentional deficit disorder. And often, you know, they're, you know, highly successful business people or surgeons or so on. So I think we need to be careful about over-diagnosis. I don't have any quick solution to this issue. But as teachers get more professionalized in the way I was calling for, they'll have more sensitivity to these syndromes. They'll be able to distinguish people who really have attentional problems and can be helped from people who just need to be told to sit still and not run around. And they'll be able to give more what I call individually oriented education, which helps individual kids. But this is a worldwide problem. When we make more demands of students, those students who have difficulties are going to be in a more tenuous position, and only highly professional educators can deal well with those kinds of problems.
We're talking with Dr. Howard Gardner. Sherry, thanks so much for that call. The number is 410-319-8888. He wrote an open letter to President Obama. Don't do anything. It talks about education. You can go to steinershow.org and read that open letter. It's not that long to join us here for this conversation. And Dr. Gardner is the Hobbs Professor of Cognition Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, best known to many for his theory of multiple intelligences. And one of his latest books is Five Minds for the Future, 410-319-8888. But I want to come back to where you left off before we went to Sherry, before we go back to our next caller. I mean, if we were seriously, if this administration was to wrestle with the ideas simply put forward in your letter in terms of what national education policy should be, and we think about all the different school districts in America, different approaches, different bodies of students, culturally and economically different bodies of students. You can have everything in America from Montessori schools to Waldorf to progressive education to military education to much more disciplined education. That we have all those parameters of education, all those ideas in education. Then implementing the ideas you're talking about here, because you're saying do nothing, but you're actually saying do something. And so how would that change the way we approach, do you think Congress and the president should approach our policy towards education nationally?
Okay, well, that's a great question, which requires more time than I think we have.
We have time, if you ask, that's an important question, so I'll let it go.
I wish when you said, Gardner said, do nothing, that you would have a colon, because what I really ask them to do is to listen,
right,
and to model. And model means not only how does he behave and what does he honor and how, but also to call attention to programs which are effective, and not to impose them. I think that's where the mistake often occurs, but rather to provide help to people who want to be able to implement programs which they think would be effective. I agree with you, the implication of your question, we can't have 15,000 districts and 80,000 schools doing whatever they want. That's preposterous. What I've suggested in earlier writing is that in the United States, we could probably make do with 6 to 12 what I call pathways. And pathways are kindergarten through secondary curricula where they were present all over the country because there are not that many of them. It's kind of like phone services or airplane companies. And you elect which of the 6 to 12 pathways you want your child to be in, kindergarten through 12. And each of these has its own form of assessment and its own form of accountability. And we trust them to monitor themselves, except for things like, you know, health or finance, which you need to have some kind of external surveillance. But systems like this have actually worked quite well in many parts of Europe. There isn't need to have one system, but there is need to have a manageable number. Mm-hmm. And what I've often said, we could do it in this country with 6 to 12, and for the 1% that wants a waiver, if they can make a good case, let's let them have a waiver. Because those people who have lots of resources will often pick very special kinds of schools for their kids. My wife went to a school called Putney in Vermont. It's very artistically oriented. It's very much oriented toward the land, kids farm, and so on. And nobody would say you can't get a good education at Putney. Many of the most celebrated people in our country have gone there. And I wouldn't remove that kind of possibility. But I would say half a dozen to a dozen pathways would be enough. And then you would avoid the one size fits all. Because to put it in a kind of a brutal way, No Child Left Behind was really developed for cities like Baltimore or D.C. or Detroit, which have very serious problems in the inner city, which we all know about, and there are extraordinary measures such as those that Michelle Rhee are implementing in Washington, D.C., make a certain amount of sense. But to say that, you know, in Bethesda that the same thing should be done or in Arlington is absurd.
We have one of those people here in Baltimore running our school system. I think actually he did get his Ph.D. at Harvard, and that's Dr. Andres Alonso,
okay,
who's the new CEO of City Schools here. Let me go back to the phones. I want to come back and explore a bit more of what Dr. Gardner just said. 410-319-8888. Joe in Edmondson Village, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Joe.
It was disappointing just to hear some of the about the person here. Alonzo, I'm a school teacher here. And I think a couple of things are going on. I think people like Alonzo and Rhee and D.C., they don't have enough experience to work with inner city children. I know they're educated, Harvard educated, but... I believe I'm a school teacher. I'm Yale educated, but that won't qualify me for working with the students here. One of the things I think No Child Left Behind is doing, and it, I think it does to urban systems, is you create a lot of people trying to meet test scores, and that's what's actually happening. I talked to someone who worked down in Baltimore City, and they were telling me in administration, you know, on North Avenue, they were saying special ed kids are scoring higher than than the average kid. And I'm a special educator. And I said, you know why? And I see it in my school. Now, I don't blame the people who try to help the kids, but if you take a standardized test and a monitor walks around and the child makes a mark and if the ABCD and you say, no, that's not good, try the next one. Many of us are helping the kids with the test. So you'll see improved test scores, but the kids aren't really learning anymore. And the last thing I wanted to say is that, nothing is going to make up for smaller class sizes, especially in areas where kids don't get attention or get education at home, and it's going to cost money, and that's the thing we're avoiding. We're avoiding spending money on the people who need the most, and what we do is spend money on the people who need the least. And until we address that the education is not going to change for people in cities. That's my comment.
Thank you so much. Howard Gardner?
I think that I align myself with the spirit of what the caller said. Obviously, in the short run, we're not going to be able to have smaller classes because the money isn't there. Our states are hemorrhaging deficits. But then it's up to educators to try to capture as much of the small class as you can in a large class by breaking the class up, by making use of older kids, making use of monitors. You can be smart about that, though nobody in his right mind would rather have 40 kids in a class than 20. But just realistically speaking, that's not going to happen in the next few years. I agree about the risks of putting somebody in charge of a school system if they don't have a lot of experience in education themselves. But I think the solution there is for such people to surround themselves with individuals who are very experienced and to take what they say seriously. Just yesterday, Leon Panetta was declared to be the head of the CIA,
right.
And many people said, well, he has no experience there. I think the big question is not what experience does he have himself, but does he make strategic use of people who have a lot of experience while using the managerial and congressional experience that he has in a positive way? What I think we could all agree at is the people with a lot of training, whether it's at the CIA or in running school systems, have not been good. That's the sad fact. I mean, if you run through the last CIA people, someone like Richard Bissell, was that his name, who
mm-hmm.
was so beloved in there, was a disaster as the head of the CIA. And people who didn't have a lot of experience, actually including Bush Sr., did a pretty good job. Similarly, a lot of the educators who've had a lot of experience running school districts, urban districts, just go from one to the other. They claim to raise the test scores, even if they've only been there for 2 years, and they move on to another place. So when things get very, very bad, it's a reaction. In a sense, it's analogous. I hang around all sorts of people who really complain about Sarbanes-Oxley, which is the legislation which requires corporations to be very, very scrupulous about how they report their finances.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, oh, this is so oppressive. And I say, well, look, you guys screwed up. Look at Enron. When you screw up, that's the reaction that takes place. And that's why we have generals and legislators running school districts, because unfortunately the people who are running them did not do a good enough job. Nonetheless, I repeat, in the long run, there's no substitute for involvement of parents, or as Hillary Clinton would say, it takes a community to raise a child. And there's no There's no substitute for a respected teacher corps. And one of the biggest problems with No Child Left Behind, which we didn't mention yet, is it basically tends to deprofessionalize teachers because it makes them into coaches for test taking. And I absolutely agree with the caller. I would have absolutely no objection to standardized tests if every year we had a quite different one, so there'd be no way to coach kids for it. But of course, what happens in every district is a new test comes in, people get test savvy, the test scores go up, then a new test comes in, and the scores are back down again because the kids learned how to take a certain test. They didn't learn how to think well or how to solve new kinds of problems. And that's a tremendous difficulty with almost every state. I have to say, I come from Massachusetts, and I think we have one of the better systems. We have a comprehensive assessment test called the MCAS. It's a pretty good test. And to my amazement and delight, in the last round, which just was reported some weeks ago, Massachusetts kids are actually doing as well as kids in some of the countries that we look at with envy. And so it can be done better. And if I were Obama, maybe I would say you should take a look at Massachusetts health insurance and take a look at Massachusetts assessment systems, because they've worked pretty well.
Before we go to break, let's take one or two more callers and a final question for Dr. Howard Gardner at 410-319-8888. We have his essay up on our website at steinershow.com.org, 410-319-8888. Russ in East Baltimore, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark, to you and Dr. Gardner.
Greetings to you.
Education is one of those areas where I think we really need to go backwards rather than try to go forward, because I say that because I'm a product of the Baltimore City Public School System. And during the years that I went to school from 54 to 66, we had an excellent education system here. Just plain excellent. A lot of the tests that were later developed were started based on the model that here in Baltimore City. Now, personally, I think that we kind of sidestepped some issues, because I think the underlying demise of our education system, it was racism. And I think a lot of these specialized programs that we bring in along, like the previous caller says, try to sidestep the effects of that. But because what happened with that is the money disappeared as schools became more and more black. But that's one issue. The second issue is, I think today we're dealing with a totally different type of student than we dealt with in the days that I went to school. The education is not emphasized as much in a home and a house, because a lot of the homes aren't stable enough to create an environment for students to become good students. And then lastly, I think that, and looking at ethics, a lot of the scores are skewed, and some schools are considered better than others based on test scores, without a consideration of the amount of unethical behavior that takes place in obtaining those scores. In other words, cheating. So I'd just like to throw those 3 points out and see how the professor reacts.
Thank you so much, Russ. And before we run out of time, Howard Gordon, could you start with the last piece of his question, which had to do with ethics, because I really want to explore more detail how you instill a sense of ethics in our educational system, how you change that dynamic.
Well, the first community that the child enters after the family is the school. And the way that decisions are made, the way that policies are discussed and implemented and changed, is the child's first lesson in what it means to be responsible or irresponsible. And of course, as both callers have said, if teachers are surreptitiously giving answers to kids, they're just modeling what it is to cheat. And the most recent study shows that 2/3 of American kids admit to having cheated in the past year, mm-hmm. and 1/3 of them admit to having stolen from a store. And this is the Josephson poll where 30,000 kids were studied. These kids did not go to schools where those kinds of behaviors were sanctioned. They went to schools where they were ignored or there were no penalties. So I think the school has to be a very important place. And that's why I've been spending the last half dozen years working at secondary schools and in colleges with kids on ethical issues. For people who want to follow that, go to the web to goodworkproject.org, goodworkproject, and read about our toolkit. Let me just say, I thought the analysis of the last caller was very good, but there are two differences from the time when he went to school and now. One is we are making more demands of kids now than we did 30 or 40 years ago. Number two, when we went to school, there was a captive audience, namely women, because that was the only job which they were pursuing in those days. Mm-hmm. And now, well, good for women, they can pursue any job. But with all due respect to the teaching cohort, it's not drawing on half of the population as it was in earlier decades.
Dr. Howard Gardner, it's been a pleasure to talk to you as always. We look forward to talking to you again soon. And thank you so much for your thoughts and your work for the children of this country. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Mark, and thank the callers. Very, very thoughtful remarks.
Thank you so much. Take care. And you can read what he wrote up on our website, steinershow.org. We're going to take a very short break. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. When we return from break, we're going to be talking with Dr. Charles Murray, author of the controversial book, The Bell Curve. But more recently, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that argues Barack Obama should use his stature to undermine bachelor's degrees as a job qualification. You can read it while we're at break at steinershow.org. We'll come back with our conversation with Charles Murray. Stay with us.
Support for WEAA is provided by
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Our focus is education and the incoming administration and ideas from different educational thinkers in our country. We talked to Dr. Howard Gardner. We're now talking to Dr. Charles Murray, who was the author of the controversial book, Bell Curve. His most recent book, which was released in 2008, is titled Real Education, Four Simple Truths for Bringing America's Schools Back to Reality. He recently published an op-ed in the New York Times that argues Barack Obama should use his stature to undermine bachelor's degrees as a job qualification. You can read it while we're on the air here at steinershow.org. He's now at the American Enterprise Institute. And Charles Murray, welcome. Good to have you on the program with us. Hello, you there? Charles Murray, do we lose him?
I'm not coming through.
Yeah, are you there? We got you. Good.
Good.
I got scared for a minute, but there you are. That's good.
Me too.
410-319-8888 is the number here. 410-319-8888. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So let me let you, as our listeners can go up on the web and read what you've written if they hadn't seen already. This is not a new theory for you. You've been writing about this idea for years.
Yeah, I've gotten more upset as time has gone on, though, because the BA, and let me make it very clear from the beginning, I'm not against higher education. I am against the straitjacket of the 4 years residential college, very expensive, that you have to do to get the BA, and you have to have the BA to get your foot in the door for a job interview for all kinds of jobs that don't need 4 years of that kind of training.
So let's talk about what that means. I mean, the people have when you look at what you're writing here, you talk about, do you think President Obama should use his bully pulpit to undermine the bachelor's degree as a job qualification? Let's just start there.
Right. And he should, every time he talks about higher education, and he has some good ideas on higher education. He wants to expand the use of community colleges,
mm-hmm.
in favor of that. He wants tuition tax credits. I think that's a good idea. But he ought to be saying, every time he talks about those, it ought to be what a person can do that counts when they go in for a job interview, not where they learned it and not how long it took them to learn it. I'd like him to say that over and over again.
Now, we've gotten to a place in America where if a bachelor's degree is your ticket into almost every job you can imagine.
Yeah, and let's just take a couple of specific examples.
All right.
Of why I think it's foolish. Let's say you have a young person who wants to go into business, wants to work for a corporation in marketing. Well, there are some marketing courses beyond the high school level that person ought to take. But a lot of people who want to have that kind of career don't want what four-year colleges were initially designed to offer. They need to take 1 or 2 years of courses in marketing, and then they want to walk into the job interview and be able to tell the employer, look, I've got the kinds of credentials you need for the kind of job you're hiring for as management trainees. And the mechanism for that, as far as I'm concerned, is to learn from the CPA exam for certified public accountants and come up with ways of certifying people in that same kind of way.
What about the argument people would make that one of the things education is supposed to do, besides being a job training course, maybe not being a job training course, is to create a well-rounded citizen, one who understands our history, who we are, one understands the basic principles of science and mathematics, one who can appreciate literature even if you don't spend the rest of your life reading great books, that part of education, if you're an auto mechanic or a carpenter or a software designer or an interior designer, that it's that rounded individual that creates a democracy, and without that, we don't have one.
We're in danger.
I'm
all in favor of just about everything you said, but two quick points. One is, an awful lot of that can be done in K-12 education, kindergarten through high school. That's not being done now. And in the book that I published last year, I make a very strong case for that, that we have curricula out there that do precisely that and can do that at a level that the vast majority of young people can deal with. That's first point. Second point is that history and literature and philosophy taught at a genuine college level is tough. It is tough in the same way that doing a flip off a pommel horse in gymnastics is tough. Not everybody can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the extent that we have people who are drawn toward that kind of academic study at the college level who want to do it, I'm all for it. But an awful lot of people who want to become carpenters or advertising executives or a variety of other things don't want to learn that. And then the question becomes, well, should they be required to do it in order to get a higher education? That's one question. And the other question is, we aren't requiring of it in the current college system. We're sort of pretending we require it. So even if it's good that we do this in the college level, we aren't really doing it anymore at the college level. As anybody who's taken a look at a course catalog and the choices that can fulfill the distribution requirements will understand.
One of the lines you have in your article here, before we open the phones at 410-319-8888, and people are calling in, want to hear their thoughts as we talk to Charles Murray about his op-ed in the New York Times that you can now read at steinershow.org. We have it online for you to read as we talk with him here. Our number here is 410-319-8888. You write that colleges work fine for top students from all backgrounds who are drawn toward academics, but earlier you write, fine for children of parents who have plenty of money. Now, some people look at that line and say, well, that sounds pretty elitist. What about 18-year-olds from wealthy families who are who don't want to study hard or what, or just going to college because they're expected to? Or what about the thousands of people in America who go to college at night, work full time, and maybe take some 8 to 10 years to get the bachelor's degree?
Yeah, when I said work's fine, and I can see how that sounds, I'll tell you what I was thinking of. Yeah, work's fine. The kids have a good time. You know, the parents have plenty of money they can afford to pay for it. The kids aren't getting that much out of it a lot of times. By work fine, I'm thinking of the ways it doesn't work fine for people who don't have a lot of money, which is they don't want to acquire a whole lot of student debt, so forth. Now, you could say, oh, well, what we ought to do then is just pay the freight for everybody to go to college. and so the wealthy kids don't have that, you know, their nice time. And I'm saying, wait a minute. 4 years on a college campus, if the parents can afford it and the kid wants to spend the time, I'm not going to make a law preventing him from doing it. It's mm-hmm. not the greatest thing since sliced bread. There are lots more better ways to grow up, to mature, to gain life experiences. I am, in a broader sense, Mark, I want parents to rethink this reflexive notion that, oh, the kids are out of high school, now they ought to go to college for 4 years right away. I think that college is just not all it's cracked up to be in a wide variety of ways.
Let's talk with our audience here. We're talking to Dr. Charles Murray. I'm going to have some other questions for him, but I want you to have a chance to talk with him as he wrote this really interesting op-ed, arguing that Barack Obama should use his stature to undermine the bachelor's degree as a job qualification, which would literally change our educational system to allow those who want to go to work to study to do that and then go to work as opposed to be in a four-year college and grow in deeper debt. 410-319-8888. What are your thoughts about that? Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And Linda in Towson, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Dr. Murray, I did read your piece in the Sunday Times, and every word out of your mouth, I agree 100%. Absolutely fantastic. My own daughter is 23, and she graduated from a high school here in Towson. Was accepted to college, but we fell into that gap of being well enough off not to have everything paid for, but not sufficiently well off. to be able to pay for it.
Like most of America, unfortunately, right?
So she ended up not going to school, has had various jobs and has found the thing that she wants to do, did go for 1 year to college and found that it was remedial classes. She was bored out of her mind. She asked if she could skip, if she could get ahead. No. Basic requirements, liberal arts, you will all go through this mill, whether you like it or not, whether you already know it or not. She got so discouraged with that and thought, why am I paying money that I'm working three jobs to come up with to be taught something I already know? And she couldn't get past that block. So now she's out on her own. She's in New York City. She has worked here and there, and she's looking for a new job. And those people she has worked with have been delighted with her and delighted with her skills. But in applying for jobs, and invariably it's online, with word searches where employers have asked for at least a bachelor's degree, mm-hmm. her application is thrown out before they even see her.
That, Matt, you are my object lesson in why I wrote that editorial. and why
you.
I said what I said in the book, that it is punishing to her for no good reason.
For no good reason.
She doesn't have the bachelor's degree. We have, you know, in my own family, one of my nephews, most of my nephews and nieces have gone to college. A couple of them didn't. And the one who didn't, he tried it. He had exactly the same experience your daughter had. He's developed an excellent career as a lighting designer. But college wasn't right for him. And why should we punish people because they don't want to get that peculiar thing called a BA?
Linda, I really appreciate your call. You really helped put things in context for us. I'm going to get another call in here, and I'm going to have another question. Then I'll have another question for our guest, Charles Murray, 410-319-8888. And Isaac, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. I guess the question I have is it's more so, I think what we're looking at in the grand scheme of things is how do we populate the workforce with capable professionals? And so when we talk about, okay, you know, eliminate the need for a college degree. You know, there are programs out there right now, you know, that they say that you're getting your degree, but, you know, it's not in the traditional sense where, you know, you can go online or go by remote class by remote session and complete these programs in less than a year, and you're supposed to have your degree. Well, you know, how do you suggest that people would fare any different by you know, just going and out from high school and getting, you know, professional experience off the cuff, or going through these tailored programs, then how much different do you think they'll fare than these folks who are out here subscribing to these programs where they say, well, we'll give you the job training that you'll need in less than a year? Because I tell you, I have friends who subscribe to those programs, and they're right now having a very difficult time finding a job. And I don't think it's just not just because they don't have a traditional degree, mm-hmm. but, you know, there's one thing either to train someone to be a laborer or you need to train someone to be a thinker. You know, so if I'm teaching, if I, you know, as far as my kids are concerned, you know, they have to be, they have to learn how to work. They have to labor to make money. But I want them really to be thinkers so they aren't trapped and tunneled into a certain labor pool and unable to escape, you know. You look at right now.
Isaac, I think your question is really a very powerful question because you're talking about how we also don't track our children in this process. Charles Murray?
The caller also put his finger on, I think, one of the most powerful positive forces for change when he talked about the online courses that are becoming available mm-hmm. and how you can have distance learning. If you take a look at the trajectory of that technology, it's getting better and better and better all the time. I've taught seminars at distance using video capabilities. And I want to tell you that the experience is very, very close to the experience that you have when you're in the classroom with the students. And all of these are mushrooming. And here's the good news is it's easier and easier, as the caller suggested, for people to get what they want through all sorts of new means that don't involve going to live at a residential campus. That's good. The bad news, which he also pointed out, is that this training does not yet have the respect that it deserves in the workforce. And it goes back to the traditional BA again. So that's why I think that something that President Obama could do is, in a sense, he can expose the false shell that the BA has become. It's not that you need to have a lot of government programs or anything to do it. People just need to start saying the BA doesn't mean anything anymore, and let's quit putting such false importance on it.
Two questions here. I'm sorry. What was the last thing you said, Charles?
It's very much a psychological change in perspective that's required.
Two questions here. Some people have argued that your work, especially in this particular area, is kind of literally calling a huge number of people in America just not bright enough to handle college. And I was reading a study from the National Center for Education Statistics that said 69% of all the high school graduates, I'm reading it here now, enrolled in 2 to 4 year colleges, went to college, even though only 28.6 of those graduated between ages of 25 and 29, 67% of those ended up graduating with a bachelor's degree 8.5 years later because they had to work and they worked their way through. So they completed the courses. So, but I'm just throwing out that statistic to ask you to talk about this issue, saying are you saying that that people are not bright enough to finish college, or that college is not needed?
I'm hesitating because we're wading into a very complicated.
No, I know we are. That's why. Yeah.
But let me say a couple of things. First, you can get a degree with a very wide range of intellectual ability these days because there are lots of places where you, in effect, get through college and you can take the easy courses and you can squeak through. All right. The College Board did a systematic study, said, okay, look, you've got tens of thousands of kids with SAT scores. They've taken them. Let's see what happened to them in their freshman year. And they were asking statistically, what is the SAT score that is statistically the threshold for a 65% probability of getting a 2.7 grade average in the freshman year or better? And they defined that as college readiness, okay? And that's not a very demanding standard if you think about it. And we're not talking about what the SAT should do. We're just saying that's the fact. Here are the SAT scores associated with that outcome. The SAT score that was required is one that only about 10% of American 18-year-olds could get if all 18-year-olds took the test. So the statement that traditional college-level material is too intellectually tough for lots of people is simply not a matter of argument. I mean, there that and lots of other data say the same thing. And before I have listeners calling me up and saying what an elitist I am, come on. I could not have completed a college major in, let's say, physics. I could not. I'm too dumb to complete a BA in physics, all right? I'm too dumb to complete a BA in all sorts of majors. And there are, by the way, people who can complete a BA in physics who couldn't complete one in Renaissance history. To say that people are not able to do college-level work is not... It's nothing new, and it's something all of us are unable to do some kinds of college-level work. But the second aspect of it is, yeah, you have lots of people who can get a BA if they work hard enough and take enough time and all that. And how many of those are shaking their heads as they're going through this saying, this is not what I want to do. I'm wasting my time. I'm wasting my money. There's got to be a better way.
Dr. Charles Murray is our guest. We're talking about his recent op-ed in the New York Times asking Barack Obama to use his stature to undermine bachelor's degrees as job qualification. We have to change how we think about education in America. The number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can go to steinershow.org to read his essay from the New York Times online while we talk to him, 410-319-8888. So then let me ask you a very practical question. And I might pursue what you said a little bit if we have time, but I want just a very practical question. How do you reform the educational system in America to reflect the idea you have? I mean, I've heard from Howard Gardner about his idea about how you reform education systems K through 12, but how do you reform the system to make what you're suggesting work?
You've got a lot of forces all interested in having these kinds of changes, okay? Think about it for a minute. Think of all of the people who are currently engaged in the online at distance learning who would love to see a deflation of the BA as a job requirement and a substitution of certifications, because the online industry knows that it can't compete with the prestige of a college diploma from a residential college. They're looking for that kind of stuff. Employers already know that the BA doesn't mean much of anything anymore. It's just kind of a cost-free screening device for them. They need better information about their applicants. And you have all sorts of students who, as we've been talking about with a couple of the callers, want to have a way of showing what they can do without doing the four-year thing. When you've got that many people in whose interest it is to change the way things are done, you've got a potential for it to happen. And a lot of it is just simply that nobody says it enough. Mm-hmm. Mark, when I published the book, I can't tell you how many emails I got from people who started out the email saying, I never thought I'd agree with you about anything. Because, you know, there is a damn right reaction that I get with this that is really interesting. Where lots and lots, and very few people, who will systematically call up and say, oh, college is wonderful. You're just way underestimating how much good it's doing these kids. I get almost none of that. So I think we got a Wizard of Oz phenomenon here. You know, you yank back that curtain, and it's a little old man with glasses. Well, you yank back the curtain in the BA, and it is a largely fraudulent educational experience for large proportions of kids who go through the process to get it. I think that's a reality that more and more people are aware of.
Let me reopen the phones here, and as we talk to Charles Murray, 410-319-8888, and Robert in Timonium, you're on the air.
Hi, I struggle with the point the caller's making. I graduated from Baltimore Public City Schools in the mid-70s. I have a technical degree and a technical career, but for a lot of things, there are basic things, or I guess you might want to call them as a common body of knowledge,
mm-hmm.
that you need to have to work in that field. There are also other things, I guess you call it soft rewards for educating yourself or being educated.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a black man. Without that education, there'd be a very huge gap between what I am able to do and provide for my family. I can't measure the effectiveness of how young people are earning their bachelor's degree, even though I have a young man, that my son, who's in college, and one is getting ready to go. But I understand that the biggest thing that I got out of my degree is that, hey, I have accomplished this goal. I can learn, and even more important is I don't know everything, but it also tells my employer is that I'm trainable. And
well, Robert, let me.
I truly disagree with him. I think he is off the hook.
Okay, we only have a few minutes left, so I want to give Charles Murray a chance to respond.
Well, you want to be able to tell the employee you're trainable, yes, but do you have to get the degree in order to do that? It's a very rough indication of how trainable you are. It tells the employer a certain amount, that you have a certain amount of perseverance, that you stuck through to get the degree, and you have a certain amount of intelligence. There are lots of ways to demonstrate that besides spending 4 years at a residential facility. So I'm talking about walking into the employer with real skills, with real things you've learned, and being able to demonstrate that to him. And right now, you got to have that piece of paper with the words BA or BS on it, and the alternative ways in which we could enable you to prove the same kind of thing are out there and available. The BA is actually a very inefficient way of demonstrating those things.
Charles Murray, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you. You'll join us again. Thank you for shaking up our minds.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. We'll remind everybody to please join us for the Annapolis Political Summit this January 14th in Annapolis to meet the governor and ask your questions. 443-934-1111. Join us there. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Mike Nice, interns Christian Aronson and Judith Lloyd. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner, and take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.